Welcome to Kimmy Goes episode 442. I'm the boss, Mike Ass, aka Wheels, and with me as always.
Born to run, David McBurney, Kimmy Master.
Living on a prayer, your managed pen, Michael Baker, Gaiji Minogatari.
Oh my god, that's the wrong New Jersey musician.
Wow.
And this is Smokin' Joe Gamer. I just jumped in. And I want to know, have you ever seen the rain?
It's not New Jersey at all.
But also, I've seen fire and I've seen rain.
I can see clearly now this rain has gone.
Yeah.
Because I don't care which day we're in, we're just doing karaoke.
I did also sing Looking Out My Back Door. That was my CCR for the karaoke. Looking at my back.
Well, we've taken a wrecking ball to these music jokes.
Bring out your wrecking ball.
No, not that one. No, not that one.
No,
no, no, not that one. The Bruce Springsteen one.
I was scared for what was about to happen.
I always like.
I only know that song from the Weird Al medley.
Yeah. I like the album Nebraska from Bruce Springsteen. That's an acoustic album.
It is a good album.
Yeah.
Okay, we are off to a rip roaring start.
Wow.
Yes, welcome to Comics Quest, where I'm going to complain about comics for the next 2 to 5
God
hours.
God damn it. Wheels, you get 5 minutes.
Okay.
I'm being generous.
Oh, that's even more than I expected. Marvel's killing the Ultimate Universe again.
Again?
They keep doing
again.
This. Keep
I did not realize it was that.
They keep killing things
sort
they call
of?
The Ultimate Universe.
Yes, so the new Ultimate Universe is some alternate universe where the Maker, a.k.a. the evil Reed Richards from the original Ultimate Universe, went over and tried to manipulate time and basically shape it into his perfect superhero-free world. Obviously, that didn't work out. So the whole line has been building up to a confrontation with the Maker. I mean, the line was so popular, I think my assumption, and probably the assumption of many other people, is that it would continue after the conclusion of that said storyline, and you know, it'd be a whole fun new universe to explore. No, instead, all those books are just ending, and many of the popular characters have died, and it's just... I have yet to see someone say a positive thing about how it's all breaking down. And a few of the comics just kind of ended. Like, not like a touching send-off or anything, just ended.
With a whimper, not a bang.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good at all. Meanwhile, DC's own take on doing an alternate universe, they are doubling down on and adding more books, including a version, an undead version of Green Arrow, who's hunting down evil billionaires.
Mysterious.
It sounds wonderful.
I'm not sure why he needs to be able to be doing that, but okay.
Oh, I can understand why he would be doing that.
I just don't understand why he would have to be undead to be doing it.
Well, it's
I don't think those are per se related.
Yeah, I mean this. I don't know if you're familiar with this. Is the absolute DC universe, and kind of the whole conceit of it is that all the heroes kind of have very different origins, missing very particular things that their original versions have, like Superman. Shows up as like a young adult and kind of has no one, and it kind of presents a much different version of him. Still very similar, but kind of a much different origin and a much different story. Batman is not rich, and all the traditional villains, excuse me, not all, many of the traditional villains are actually his friends and not really villains, like the Joker and Killer Croc and Two-Face, who I guess was kind of a friend for Bruce Wayne anyway. But
yeah, like that's the least surprising one on yes. that list, but it's still like Batman and his good friend the Joker. Mysterious.
The Joker in it is extremely weird and creepy.
As it should be.
Yes, and Wonder Woman is the last Amazon and was raised in hell.
That's a rough one. I would not want to be raised in hell.
But she is also, that comic is, might be secretly the best one of all of them, honestly. Like, just the different ways it weaves in, like, Greek mythology and stuff. It's very good, and I think underappreciated a bunch. Green Lantern is, instead of, like, the, you know, nice, clean, like, general audience friendly sci-fi is very like, oh, these things are extremely alien. Yeah. Like, multiple of them get powers and it's very weird. And then there's Martian Manhunter, which I haven't even read yet, and is its very own weird thing.
As it should be.
Yes.
But I'm gonna, as an outsider, I'm gonna praise two DC things that are happening right now. One, they are willing to sell me decent graphic novels for like prices that are at least somewhat competitive with manga.
Yes.
Which is to say I can purchase like the run of All-Star Superman or Crisis on Infinite Earths or like a bunch of other like random iconic storylines for any given character for $9.
Yes.
That is like an impulse price number.
You ever wanted to know what that whole Batman Hush storyline is? You can get that for $10.
Yes.
That whole Supergirl storyline the movie's based on, $10.
Yeah, that is an impulse price number.
Yeah.
That is a number that a non-committed fan might actually spend. The other thing is that the trailer for Lanterns looks fun.
Yes, it does.
We have invented an interesting Hal Jordan, and it is by making him a curmudgeonly old man.
Wow.
As it should be.
As it should be.
John Stewart forever. Yeah. Oh,
turning the Lantern Corps into like a sort of like buddy cop and thing is a smart instinct.
That reminds me, I completely forgot to talk about Absolute Flash, like my favorite DC superhero. Which you're wondering, oh god, they've found a way to bring back Barry Allen. No, he dies in issue number one. He gone.
No wonder your favorite.
Yes. Wally West forever. And they've already introduced the character that becomes his wife in the original series, and she's cool. So
nice.
It's good times. They did a really cool version of Mirror Master. And Captain Cold is a good guy, so
good to see at least one comic company, U.S. comic company, not like shitting the bed.
No, and then praising the Absolute line, their regular comics are doing very well now. They just did a very silly but very fun whole event where it was all about, it was called KO, and it was. They came up with some weird convoluted reasons that superheroes had to fight each other. And ultimately it was this is kind of dumb, but this is fucking awesome.
There is currently an ongoing crossover between DC and Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yes.
But.
True story.
Or one.
Who'd win in a fight? Batman or Sonic?
Yes.
It's a trick question. Batman always wins.
It features Sonic the Hedgehog and his friends teaming up with the Justice League to fight the new god, Darkseid.
Good times.
Beautiful.
Nice.
10 out of 10, no notes. Now, go make us a good DC video game, someone. Anyone? Oh, wait, Lego Batman comes out this week.
Oh, yeah.
That looks fun.
That looked cool. Yeah. Yeah.
Mysterious. Yeah, I'm looking forward to Supergirl. That looks like fun.
It does look like fun.
Yeah, it looks like she's female John Wick. Like, You poison my dog. Now you'll die.
Yeah. No, she doesn't kill people.
No. Okay. Never mind then.
She'll just maim them.
She'll maim them.
But they have done, like, one of the things that is always hardest to do with a character like that in a medium like film where you only get a few cracks at them, you know, like an attempt every year or so, is to make a, is to make sure that, like, she is sufficiently distinguished from Superman. And it looks like they've got a handle on that.
Yeah.
So then Power Girl is
a different
Supergirl
character.
From a different universe? Or
that is Earth 2.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. So, yeah. I'll watch Man of Tomorrow.
I guess that begs the question, does Earth 2 still exist in current continuity? Who can say?
Depends on who's in control at this exact moment.
Yes.
No, but yes, but maybe. It depends on when the writers decide they need it again.
That's true.
Yep. I remember looking up, like, at least one case where, like, I can't remember which Earth it was, but, like, whether there was a dash, not a dash, if its name was spelled out or a number, were all different worlds.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I'm just going to leave this.
There's
to you
a
guys.
Reason Crisis on Infinite Earths had to happen.
Yes. And then other continuity resetting things. But hey, it's good to refresh things every now and then.
Infinite, or, you know, you could actually try and make new series that are not basically retelling
Never.
The same story ever again.
Never.
Never.
Never. Never.
Quiet, you.
Got Infinite Crisis on Infinite Earths, and then Final Crisis on Infinite Earths. Guess what? Not the last one. More ruins
have been destroyed. And somebody's digging up the thesaurus to see how many different synonyms for final and last you can get.
So when's Final Fantasy 17 coming out?
Eventually.
Right at the same time as Final Super Ultimate Infinite End Crisis.
My guess would honestly be 2031.
Now, it's my understanding that there's some kind of new cut of Avengers Endgame that they want you to watch before seeing Avengers Doomsday.
Motherfucker, I ain't doing homework.
No, me neither.
No, who said that? That's no.
They did, the Russos have recut it to add some Doomsday shit.
Why?
Because over the past 10 years, the Russos have lost their goddamn minds.
Apparently.
That's why.
Don't ask them what they think about. Don't ask them what they think about Spider-Man Holmes origin. We don't think he felt responsible for Uncle Ben.
What?
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 That's this whole goddamn thing. Right?
Let's get this pulled
up.
Can Uncle Ben died, it's my fault, and now I have to be a vigilante to make up for it.
Can I just get beyond the Spider-Verse and then flip off Marvel movies for a long time?
That'd be good,
possible.
Peter Parker wasn't... Joe Russo says Peter Parker wasn't responsible for Uncle Ben's death in the MCU. If he blamed himself for Uncle Ben's death, I think he becomes a very different character.
No, if
I mean,
he doesn't
have to be directly responsible for his death to still feel survivor's guilt about it.
If he blames himself for his death, he becomes Spider-Man. My God.
Presumably, and I will give them this, Joe Russo's not directing Spider-Man Brand New Day, so like Thank what God. He thinks about Spider-Man has nothing to do with the it's actual true. Spider-Man film.
Well, but then in No Way Home, you know, he loses Aunt May and almost goes over the edge, but then still doesn't because he's still Peter Parker, Spider-Man, he's still a good person. You know?
Let's make a comic. Let's make a film adaptation of beloved things. Bring back the Clone Saga. Where is the live action Clone Saga?
Isn't that partially is what the new movie looks like? Isn't that the saga? Yeah. Didn't he grow? Didn't he have all the weird mutations in the Clone Saga?
Don't remember that being a Clone Saga thing. I think the human spider bit. I think that was a thing. Different
story. Yeah. Did he?
I can't quite remember because I've got mostly memories of the animated series.
In the Brave New Day comics or whatever, Brand New Day. Did he get like actual webbing instead of manufactured webbing?
He had had actual webbing since the early 2000s.
Okay, that's dumb.
Like that was like he got turned into a giant spider and gave birth to himself.
No, that sounds awful.
If you think that
it's
sounds
not a good
awful.
Run.
Peter Parker has been through some shit, man. You have no idea.
Yeah, I don't.
They have been trying to reset him to a status quo that even I think they don't remember anymore at this stage.
They made a deal with Mephisto to save Aunt May. A character who would probably, who if here upon hearing this plan, would be like, Peter, what the fuck are you doing? I can't. It gets worse, sir. It gets worse.
It only gets
worse. Would you like to know about the time they were back together, but then Mary Jane gets shunted off to some other dimension where time works differently, and when he finally rescues her, she's been there for multiple years with some other dude.
And has
kids. Is that Paul? Is that the guy that died?
Yeah, that's Paul. He's finally dead. I don't think anyone liked him. He sucked.
They keep like trying, like the thing that was very funny is that the theoretical point of splitting them up was to give Peter other like romantic storylines.
Yes.
And no one even remembers the other characters they tried to pair him up with.
Yes.
I don't think half of them even still exist.
He's currently dating someone he met in space.
As happens.
I mean, she's cool, but yeah. Also, by the way, Mary Jane is Venom, in case you didn't know, Joe.
Yeah, because everyone's been Venom at least once.
Yes. Yeah, I think we talked about this before, and I think I just assumed, the symbiote can attach to anybody. Sure.
Yeah.
Everyone's been a Venom.
I'm just like, at what point do we admit that the American comic industry is incredibly inbred?
I think we admitted that 40 years ago.
Yeah.
At what point do we start dealing with it properly?
None of us has the options to do that. We just read it or don't.
Yeah. I mean, DC is doing great. They're making cool stories. They're making new versions.
But again, it's still the same stories over and over again.
It's kind of what I mean. It's kind of not, actually. Like, I praise the Ultimate Universe.
Or it's a reaction to the old stories that's like, oh, this one's actually different.
I mean, everything is, even if you're making a new thing, it is in conversation with the things that you were influenced by.
Yeah.
I guess that's, don't have to be the, okay. I'm just like,
if you want new comics with new ideas, you go to indie comics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go read some Spawn.
Or don't read that.
Spawn is not something I would go to for something really original either. And honestly, the American comic book industry and culture as a whole is so ingrown on a particular style of story that even trying to move away from it, you are riffing off of it. So it's just, yep.
Again, if you get into underground and indie comics, you can find a lot of things that are other things.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually.
And occasionally some of those catch on.
Managed to be celebrated within Harvey Picard's life.
Yeah. I'm just reminded of what Ursula K. Le Guin said about Tolkien and Lord of the Rings in regards to especially American fantasy fiction of the 70s. It's like, it's, she compared it to Mount Fuji in Japanese art, where either everything was either defined by having it in there or defined by its absence of it in there.
There is no escape.
Yeah. Either way, everything was in relation to this.
We are all that with all of our culturally ambient influences.
But still, this is extreme. I mean,
yeah, again, there's a lot, there is a richness to the non-superhero American comics industry if you know where to look.
Yes, but the fact that you actually have to search for it.
I mean, you have to go looking for, like, the non-mainstream in anything. Like, yes, the AAA game industry is also thoroughly inbred, but that doesn't mean that we're not able to find things that are unique.
Yeah. I know, just comparing it to every other sphere, comics industry sphere on the planet, the fact that the American comic book industry actively strangled about 2/3 of its genres back in the 50s, voluntarily.
Semi-voluntarily.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you will always have turncoats when that kind of thing comes up.
Yeah.
It's more a degree of success, but yeah, I'm not going to throw under the bus like the, you know, thriving independent comic scene that has grown over the decades, because that's taken a lot of work from a lot of artists.
Yeah.
Thanks, Elliot. Did you come here for work? I guess you could say that.
We don't have questions at this exact moment. Oh, suddenly Fireminer appears.
Yes.
Someone just made it possible to play online Dreamcast MMO Rune Jade. Dreamcast fans, man. Yeah, I don't know. There's a certain kind of person that becomes dedicated to an individual console in a way that I will never fully understand. And you'll hear that anytime I get consternated that, like, someone posts, like, I have successfully ported this video game to Sega Genesis, Super Nintendo, Game Boy, the Amiga. And it's just like, I am mildly impressed that you managed that. I don't know why you bothered. Let's see. Speaking of which, how much was the way OG Phantasy Star Online looked and played influenced by the fact that people were going to play it on dial-up? I played World of Warcraft on dial-up, and it worked fine up to Wrath of the Lich King, but I've no idea if the contents of a modern WoW expansion would be accommodating to a dial-up connection. My suspicion would be that they would not. Like, the tiny zones, the limited number of characters instanced into a zone, it's all going to be the amount that was client side is actually another thing. Most of PSO is client side, so the amount of data being communicated through your network connection is actually pretty small. All of those are considerations that were made because many, if not most, players would be using dial-up. Actually, at the time, probably most players would have been using dial-up. So I think all of those were considerations made based on both the Dreamcast itself and the limitations of dial-up internet. Sega, as a company, were actually vocal at the time of the early... in the early aughts when Microsoft made the decision that Xbox Live would only be available via broadband, saying that they would be supporting both the Xbox and the PS2's online plans, but that they believed that dial-up had a future. And they were wrong. Dial-up did not have a future.
As it turns out, neither did landlines either.
No.
Not really, no. We were all ready to be free of the phone.
Yeah, I think I played World of Warcraft on DSL back in the day, you know? And even that was a little... Well, that was my computer at fault, though, when it was running shitty.
I played on college internet that was worse than dial-up.
Oh, no. My college had a T1 line. It was amazing.
Oh, you suck.
Yeah. I went to CCSU, motherfucker, for 3 semesters and then dropped out after failing 2 classes. But that's beside the point.
Tell me more.
Anyways. Tell me more.
Tell me more. Okay. Did you know that some Walmarts have put electronic price tags on shelves so they can do dynamic pricing? Yes, actually, not just Walmarts. My local Safeway has also done this. My friend in Seattle, hey, shout out, recently posted a picture of a retro store where some games have the word internet written onto their price tags. What you do is bring those games to the counter, and the owner will check eBay to see how much they usually sell for. You just can't help but finding good deals. Like, okay, gonna put this out there for retro store owners. If you are going to sell me this for exactly the same price as it is on the internet, I will simply get it on the internet.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You have to provide some service other than being right next to me. There is no universe where I need a retro game that fast.
Yes, and we also know that you paid less for whatever you're selling it for. So what the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you've I understand, like you gotta make your money somewhere, but like if you're like dynamic pricing in that fashion, like it's just, why am I bothering with you?
Yeah.
I'd be curious to know which one that is. I know of a few retro game stores around here, but I have not seen any that are like that.
Yeah, and then the issue I ran into with trying to sell stuff to those kind of places is that sometimes the price they'll offer you for a trade-in is based on what the bidding price is on eBay. You know what I mean?
Which is even stupider, yeah.
Exactly. So I stupidly paid like $80 or $90 for a World of Warcraft Valyra action figure once. Don't know why I did that. Went to this vintage toy store in some mall that was like an hour away because they said, oh yeah, we buy toys and action figures, sure. And then he's like, oh, well, I'll give you like $15 for it because, you know, I see bids for $20. I'm like, fuck you. But I still did it though because I didn't want it anymore. Yeah. It sucks.
At that point, you're paying for the convenience.
Yeah, Wheels, how much did that place give you for like my old GameCube controller? You know, that was probably like $3.
Not very much.
Yeah.
But it was pretty more dirty.
Like ShameCube.
ShameCube. I love the GameCube, but I'm not obsessed with it the way these Dreamcast weirdos are, you know.
Yeah, there's definitely like a contingent of people online who grew up with GameCubes who genuinely seem unaware of how badly it did. It's fascinating how that like leaves history, because like the absolute sales numbers are simply not that relevant to people's memories, but like it is something. Let's see. Okay, but yeah. Let's see. It's a missed opportunity that while a big part of the .hack anime's success has to do with its soundtracks, none of the games are composed by Yoko Kanno. She was on a generational run in the 90s and 2000s, absolutely. From Macross Plus to Cowboy Bebop to Ghost in the Shell to Macross Frontier. And then you look at her game credits and over half of them are Koei strategy games. Yeah, I mean, partly part of the reason, I would suspect part of the reason that she wasn't doing a lot of games is that games are generally like RPGs especially are generally really big soundtracks, and she was clearly quite busy. So you know, you would need to be paying the kind of money to make it worth her while. And you know, if you're doing a random ass RPG, you probably you know, no, in 2000, you probably weren't paying better than, you know, some of the anime that she was doing at the time. The other thing to note would be she did have a Dreamcast soundtrack. Dreamcast keeps coming up. Nappletale. and she showed back up for the Cowboy Bebop PS2 game, although I would imagine much of that was just reusing tracks from the show. But yeah, just I would suspect that a number of these are just that that some of this was just she was busy with other things and there wasn't someone willing to pay her to commit to a game over that. But yeah, there's a lot of like just old Koei games that she composed for. Fucking multiple Uncharted Waters, multiple a bunch of Nobunaga's Ambitions games. Fucking Genghis Khan. But yeah. So bit of a shame. I think that she probably would have made like a really like could have made a really good, memorable and varied RPG soundtrack, but I'm not gonna complain that she instead spent time doing things like Cowboy Bebop and Macross Plus. Or Turn A Gundam. All fantastic soundtracks. Let's see.
Well, if we're talking about anime, I just want to say quickly that I'm watching season 3 of Jujutsu Kaisen, and it's okay. I like it so far. Yeah.
I watched half an episode and was very bored.
Well, I got yet another free trial of Crunchyroll, so I was like, well, let's get caught up on that, and then I'm going to watch the Chainsaw Man movie.
No, you should watch Witch Hat Atelier. Thank you.
Atelier.
And also Frieren.
Oh, I also got to get caught up in Spy X Family. That's a good one.
No. Frieren.
It's on my list.
You have time to watch two shows that produce 13 episodes every 3 years.
Don't know. You mentioned anime, and I want to talk about anime quick, and that's fine. So we can go back to questions.
Okay, last week when I asked about the audience catching on to the fact that the author isn't that good, I mentioned Deadly Premonition, but you didn't touch on it. I'll ask again. And how surprising is that it only took one sequel for people to understand that Swery isn't that good? Part of the reason I didn't touch on that is that, like, I have friends who actually do quite like Deadly Premonition 2, and especially The Missing. Like, some of his later work does actually have, like, significant fandom. It's much less overwhelming than it was with Deadly Premonition, but I think that's not okay. So, like, here's what I would say: Deadly Premonition 1 is a game that people sort of thought happened by accident, and like you bring up Access Games and how like they make a lot of outsourced projects because they are a small studio that does not have a ton of money, never had a ton of money even at the best of times. So you get something like Spy Fiction or Deadly Premonition or Dark Dreams Don't Die.
Like, or bad Double Dragon games.
No, I don't think Access Games made those.
Okay.
Access Games is a specific studio. But, like, you know, like, bring those up and, like, all of those are, like, a team with nowhere near the budget of, say, Spy Fiction wants to be Metal Gear. It doesn't have anything like that budget, and it's obvious. But, like, people kind of like them for their passion project status. There are issues with Hidetaka Suehiro, certainly, especially in modern times. But I do think that, like, there's what we saw was more the divide, like a few different divides, and one of the big ones that kept that keeps those later games from getting becoming bigger things is that like a lot of people who play Deadly Premonition see an ambitious game that like was cut off, that like if he just had more time and money that it would be a much more polished experience. And then you look at the actual things that he makes before, after, and in interviews talking about it, it's like, no, he doesn't care. Like, give him a million times the budget and he's going to keep making like weird buggy shit. That's just what he does. And ultimately the audience for someone who is going to consistently do that is going to be much lower than the audience for someone that people are certain would be able to do great things if they just had a little bit more time and money. So because, like, you know, you look at, like, interviews from right after Deadly Premonition comes out, and people are asking, and, like, these got passed around a lot at the time. I'm not sure if that's kind of fallen out of the consciousness, or if people, like, faced with the reality, didn't much care for it, but at the time, like, asked, well, what would you do if you had more time and money? Is, like, you know, the obvious expected answer was, like, polish the game, fix it. And his response was, I'd add bicycles. just
bicycle.
You know,
like, bicycle. Want to ride my bicycle?
Not right now.
We've already had enough DMCA potential strikes this episode.
But yeah, like, I think that ultimately that kind of creator is not going to have long-term fandom unless you really vibe with what they do. But bear in mind, like, you know, even if people complain about, say, Dark Dreams Don't Die Now, part of the reason, like, for years, like, people were saying, where's the next episode? I want to see more of it. And it's like, well, that's Microsoft's call, and they don't care. Yeah, so, like, I have bones to pick with him, but I disagree with the notion that, like, there's no, like, meaningful cult following to his work at this stage. I think, like, the biggest stone cold killer here was, more than anything, just, like, anything to do with, like, things like recent statements about AI related to, I think, Hotel Barcelona. But... yeah. But yeah, like, you know, Access itself, they've done a lot of other stuff. Like you mentioned that they did a whole bunch of outsourcing for Bandai Namco. Like they did the PSP Ace Combats. They did some Sengoku Basara games for Capcom back when that was an ongoing concern. But yeah, I think that ultimately a lot of people will play an unpolished game or watch a like weird movie as like a once in a while thing. But if someone's going to consistently do it, like there's a pretty limited amount of people that are going to be in for that. Let's see. The old Konami had so many creator-led teams that stuff like Metal Gear Solid, Suikoden, Castlevania, Tokimeki, and International Soccer Superstar could exist at the same time. Do the modern Konami have the talent to do that? No. There's a reason that like most of their stuff gets outsourced to one team or another. There's just not enough internal talent to keep that many games running. Or are they going to hire third parties like the next Castlevania and do licensing deals? Like we're deep into that. Like they've got, I think, two or three different teams outsourced doing Silent Hill games between Bloobs doing the Silent Hill 1 remake right now, and I forget who's making Townfall. Is that Annapurna and some other thing? Let me check before I shoot my goddamn mouth off. Silent Hill Townfall, Screenburn Interactive, co-published by Konami and Annapurna. Okay. Screenburn's out of Glasgow. But yeah, like, you know, you look at both of those, like, you know, they've got two different teams making Silent Hill games, but neither of them's an internal Konami team. They don't have, like, even if they were at their height in terms of, like, the same amount, you know, if they hadn't burned off, like, a bunch of studios worth of talent, they still probably wouldn't be able to make all of those franchises concurrently to a modern standard. But yeah, like they are a publisher who contracts things at this stage. Their internal development, like it exists, but it's not huge. It's not enough to keep really any of these franchises going, even if they devoted all of it to it. It's just not what's structured. It's not the kind of people they have on hand. Let's see. Last year, I brought up the topic of the remasters of Ridley Scott's films were very, very bad. The thing is that people have been buying more old DVDs. Modern film remasters change too much of the lighting and palette that they obscure the very intention of the directors. Isn't this the movie version of Don't Play Retro Games with the filters smooth out the pixels? It's weird to see the films to get the bad remaster treatment. It's actually also extremely individual. But I will say, like, saying modern ones, like modern ones change things too much is a bit simplistic, because like the old remasters kind of did a lot of that too. It's like the very notion of film restoration is built around that. Like it was not a land of wine and roses back when we had DVDs, because you had fucking pan and scan DVDs that were some of the most mainstream ways to watch a movie, to the point where some directors were so certain that most of the audience would be watching their movies after the initial theatrical run on pan and scan that they supervised the pan and scan versions of their films and didn't bother looking at what the widescreen version was going to look like. Digital video noise reduction had a huge heyday in the mid-late 2000s. Early Blu-ray remasters are frequently terrible. Nowadays, we're actually in kind of a relatively good space with a lot of 4K remasters, because a lot of them are made for sicko perverts. Because like those are the people who will individually purchase them. And so the worst ones actually sometimes come from directors that have concerning levels of interest in technology. So like routinely the worst ones you'll hear about end up being like James Cameron's, who is overseeing all of them, and we kind of wish he would stop because he keeps wanting to like fucking filter them through whatever the newest technology is. So now like there's fucking AI shit in some of these. Yeah, like the True Lies 4K remaster is like a low watermark for film restoration.
Well, I heard that people were trying to get the original cut of Star Wars on 4K and they did it themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. People have been trying to do that for decades, but the nature but the nature of film restoration is people not having a certainty, because like you know, especially with older films, there's no certainty about what they actually might have looked like when the film was undamaged. Unless you can find, you know, original negatives, and a lot of them don't. Like, that's why infamously, like, you know, a movie as beloved as Citizen Kane, the restoration was extremely laborious. The negatives are gone.
That's a shame.
Fun fact about silver nitrate film, it's kind of dangerous to store.
It goes boop.
It can spontaneously light on fire at room temperature, depending upon the atmospheric conditions.
Wow.
Yes.
If you go back far enough,
the fire at the end of Inglourious Bastards,
mm-hmm.
the way that theater went up fire. Was probably the least unrealistic thing about that the end of that movie. lots of things weird with that movie, but
yeah,
exploding theater, not one of them.
Mm. Like, yeah, and the worst part was that, like, this is why so many of old films are gone. Like, you know, you'll see people like Scorsese throughout the statistic that 90% of films made in the silent era don't exist anymore. So there's actually two perverse incentives here. One, the nitrate film left by itself might just spontaneously destroy itself and anything around it. Two, there's silver in there. There is money to be made rendering it to get the silver out of it. So, you had something that was both dangerous to store and had literal money in it. So, yeah, a lot of stuff goes missing unless there's a very... except for whatever prints were struck. The other thing is that, like, the nature of creating masters at a sufficient age would damage the film. Or it would damage the negative. So just all sorts of things that prevent... Like, when you get back to, like, the 30s, like, that's why those films just disappear.
But yeah.
Okay, some additional stuff. But yeah, so yeah, what I would say about this is that, like, it's not necessarily that DVDs were better or more typically more faithful mastering. For films that had just come out, maybe, but for older films, it was still people taking stabs at what the color grading should be to recreate the look it would have had in theaters from projectors of that era on a modern display set. Like, there's all sorts of, like, choices being made. But let's see. Okay, some other quick ones. You already made it clear that you think Halo and Far Cry don't have enough of a setting or story for a faithful adaptation. Wheels might argue about Halo, but he's not here right now, so. By that token, is Adi Shankar's Devil May Cry justified? Is it the adaptation the franchise deserves? I have not watched it because I don't care. That said, I would say that it's justified in the sense that, like, you know, you can do whatever with it. There's, like, Devil May Cry can barely agree on how much on where it takes place. the problem with it is that it's bad on its own terms, not that it's unfaithful.
Well, the problem with the Halo series, number one, is that you would need Paramount Plus, and who the fuck wants that? The other issue is I didn't watch the Ninja Turtles. Well, I didn't watch it, but I remember Wheels telling me, like, right in the first episode, like, a kid dies and then Master Chief takes off his helmet. It's like, what the fuck are they doing? You know? So no, I don't want to watch that.
Yeah, that wasn't really the question, but
okay. But, like, Far Cry 4 would make a good movie. I just want to say that.
Yeah, the question was more about whether this, like, you know, I believe what we ultimately argued was that, like, direct adaptations of these games didn't make much sense, but that, like, indirect adaptations, there's not a lot there. So if you make something, it's mostly ornamental that it's adapted. Like, if you make a Far Cry adaptation that is not based directly on an existing Far Cry, what is that? What ties that to Far Cry? What makes that Far Cry? And that's a very difficult question to answer. So that's where this question's coming from.
Okay.
But yeah, like, for Devil May Cry, you have to match an aesthetic. But bearing in mind that the trick that Devil May Cry 5 ends up trying to pull with its narrative is trying to pretend that the prior games lined up in any real fashion. To Devil May Cry 5's credit, and to prove that you can pull a decent story out of anything, Devil May Cry 5 kind of makes that trick work, especially for the casual observer. Like, it manages to pull in just enough elements of all the prior ones to sort of make them feel more cohesive than they ever actually were. That's definitely the thing that I was feeling when I watched it, or when I played it initially. That was one of the praises that I had for it, was that the narrative, while not amazing, managed to make it feel like it was culminating, even though there's no real, like, narrative through line to the series. Like, we are talking about a series that has, within its first install, like, no one can even agree on the core inciting incident of its first installment. Devil May Cry 1 starts with Frisch, the electric demon lady, jumping into Dante, like, riding a motorcycle into Dante's shop, throwing it at him, and then asking him for help investigating. And Dante agrees to help her. In the material surrounding the original game, it's implied that the reason he does so is that she looks like his mom. Then that game also kind of made them, like, pseudo-romantic interests. And someone looked at that and was like, that's insane. We cannot continue with that. And so later games, like, later supplementary material tries to retcon it by saying that he found the fact that she looks like his mom creepy. And, like, the later games make it clear there's no romantic interest between the two. Fair. Makes sense. Good choice. But also saying that he found the fact that she looked like his mom creepy okay, then the inciting incident doesn't make sense. She threw a motorcycle at him and tried to kill him and then asked him for help, and he decided she was crazy but decided to help her anyway. That's weird. And, like, that is the overwhelming... Like, there's no... It's impossible to try to ascribe, like, a general world to Devil May Cry. Like, Devil May Cry 4 and Devil May Cry 5 are the closest in terms of what their worlds look like, and not what their worlds look like, but in terms of how their narratives connect. But their worlds are completely impossible to reconcile. Like, Devil May Cry 5's world looks like Devil May Cry 3. Makes sense. They both technically take place around the same place. Like, but then there's also, like, apparently not far from there, a world of, like, fucking, like, pseudo Catholic cult people that worship demons, and it's just like it, like the actual world you're exploring looks fucking nothing like Devil May Cry 3 or 5, and that's fine. You can do that, except for the fact that, like, the game gives no context for how far apart these places are. So presumably that's on another continent, but also everyone just went there. And yeah, like, the game doesn't care. The world of Devil May Cry is incredibly thinly sketched. You can actually do a lot with it. The problem is just Shankar's Devil May Cry doesn't totally fit and is just kind of bad on its own terms. Between those two things, you end up with this.
Is this the Netflix Devil May Cry series we're talking about?
Yeah,
assuming so.
So it's not
good. There's yeah, by all accounts, it's quite not good.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Like I said, I haven't seen it, but, like, these are the, this is where the problem runs into.
I mean, I was sold on that series by a motorcycle being thrown at the main character, so.
Yeah, so no, that's not that a
series. I don't care.
That's cool.
But yeah.
So then, okay. I was thinking about trying to revisit that reboot thing they did.
You should. It's fucking rules.
Okay.
I love that game.
So I'm just curious why they did that reboot, and then, oh, well, now we're going to do 5. But then again, Capcom has been known to go backwards like that. Or forwards, well, or whatever.
Let me make this perfectly clear. The reboot exists from an era where, like, Capcom's upper management, particularly Inafune, was very certain that, like, Japanese development was on the wane and that they needed to outsource to Western companies. So they partnered with Ninja Theory and made that. And DMC Devil May Cry actually went through a few different phases. One where it was just a prequel, and then it was a full-on reboot or a reimagining. Like, it was a number of things before it became the game that it was.
Okay. Cool.
But it's a very fun
game. Yeah. Yeah, elements of it found their way into Devil May Cry 5, even if they are not, like, canonical story elements. Okay. So, some quick ones. Gaijin knows about Blue Archive, right? It's a really popular gacha game from Nexon. The thing is that the gacha game earns a lot less than Nexon's own Maple Story, a decade-old MMORPG. But the franchise makes money from drama CDs and live events. It's interesting how a Korean game and the most successful inheritor of the successful inheritor of the Idolmaster model, while the Idolmaster franchise has several gacha games of its own. If I knew Japanese and Korean, I'd probably try to write a book about the connection between life simulation, parasocial relationships, starting from dating sims like Tokimemo and raising games like Princess Maker in the 90s to live service arcade games like Idolmaster and MMOs like Second Life in the aughts to modern gacha games. Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting things about that, but, like, I think RPGs as a whole actually owe something to the notion, or at least story-based, character-driven RPGs owe a lot to the parasociality that players have. Like, those, like, caring about a character in the way that people tend to is a core part of, like, character-based storytelling. And yeah, just a lot to unpack there. Which recurring character as plot device is your favorite? I've been getting into the Laughing Salesman anime. God, that's a deep cut, at least in English.
Whoa!
What did I say to this man? Oh, man. Okay. That is a deep cut.
Yeah, I feel like it's less of a deep cut in Japan, but in English it's definitely a deep cut.
No, I mean, it's still pretty deep cut in Japan, too.
If I were to refer to... Oh, God.
He appears sometimes, but still. Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, if I were to refer to a Western example of character as plot device, it would probably be something like Columbo, actually. Like, many if not most Columbo mysteries are essentially told from the perspective of the person that Columbo is about to catch.
Yeah, I've heard Columbo described, instead of being a whodunit, it's a how catch 'em.
Yeah, yeah. And so, in that sense, like, Columbo is the plot device that forces the narrative to happen. I would say he honestly actually does kind of fall into that. But I'm trying to think of character's plot device concept. I suppose, like, any story of the week sort of thing where, like, a character just sort of wanders in and resolves things. But man, now I'm just thinking of, like, the fucking this does not really count, but I'm just thinking of, like, the fucking man with no name. Mm-hmm. Which, again, like, the story is not about them, they just resolve it. Mm-hmm. But let's see. Is it weird that while there is an official Snoopy Game & Watch game, other Game & Watch titles just have very Charlie Brown looking characters? And again, Japanese animators were influenced by a lot by Western comics. Yeah, I mean, Snoopy is also just the most popular. I think it's just called Snoopy in Japan.
I mean, the actual books are called Peanuts, mm-hmm. but nobody remembers the title of the show or the cartoon.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, like Snoopy is the big part of the brand. So it makes sense that, like, if they're making an official Game & Watch that's branded with anything, that, like, they're gonna care more about just having Snoopy in there. Isn't it about time Nintendo re-released the Game & Watch Gallery? The DS collection had a pretty limited selection. Honestly, I think it would be cute if they just were like, NSO, Game & Watch. Here's all the games and watch.
Yeah, why not?
I think some of the galleries might be in, like, the old Game Boy galleries. Might actually be in, what was it? Sorry, my brain is dying. Some of the old Game & Watch galleries might actually be on NSO. I'd have to check. But, actually, I could check that right now. What if I did that? I'm going to wait for that to load, because I probably have some things to download on the Game Boy, Game & Watch, the Game Boy NSO, but... Wait, let me check this one.
Well, that reminds me of a question I was going to ask, mm-hmm. which is, so just today, I knew of its existence, but just today I finally looked into it. The, how do you pronounce it? The Satellaview games?
Yeah, Satellaview.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I knew that there was a Zelda game, and so I was just looking through that, and I got some files off of Internet Archive, but I guess my question is, do you think Nintendo might ever put all of those games on Switch Online? I mean, I never saw the Virtual Boy coming. No? Okay.
Like even the things you can download now are not proper, like, they're not full recreations of what the Satellaview was. Because, like, the Satellaview had, like, the full proper name, Broadcast Satellaview, involved, like, an actual, like, voice broadcast that was done live at the time. While there are recordings of what those voice broadcasts are, the rights to those actual voice broadcasts are probably an enormous mess.
Okay.
So, yeah, I don't suspect that any of those will ever see the light of day ever again.
is it worth my time to try to play the Mario and Zelda games that were on there?
Nah. BS Legend of Zelda Ancient Stone Tablets is decent. For the most part, you're basically just playing official ROM hacks.
Yeah, because then I found a site that just had ROM hacks, and it's like, oh, okay, I'll just play those.
Yeah, they're decent enough for there. Okay, it looks like Game & Watch Gallery 3 is the only Game & Watch Gallery that has been dumped onto NSO. They could probably get the rest of those. But yeah, it'd be nice just because, I mean, the Game & Watch is a very important part of Nintendo history. And I will say, for my own part, the first two Game Boy games I had were Super Mario Land and Game & Watch Gallery 1.
And I'm also one of those weirdos who loves to play Mr. Game & Watch and Smash Bros. Judge me.
Has Kojima done enough to train his team so that when he goes away, Kojima Productions will still stand? You've seen what happened to Ghibli when Miyazaki went away, and nowadays their productions slowed down to a crawl because Miyazaki can only do a single key animation sequence a month. I have no idea. I don't think anyone can know that until he actually steps away, which I don't think he will do until he is in the ground.
I thought his son was already kind of handling things.
Who are you? Whose son?
Goro.
Goro Miyazaki does exist. Don't ever look up what Hayao Miyazaki said about Goro Miyazaki's first directorial work if you want to still think of him as a nice old man.
Okay.
But yeah, like Goro, you know, has done some things that people like, but is still he lacks both the expertise and the like raw talent to take up all of the responsibilities that Hayao Miyazaki had. And beyond that, like, Miyazaki never ran Ghibli entirely by himself. Isao Takahata, I believe, was also handling a great deal of that, and he is dead. So yeah, there's a whole bunch of that. Like, I can't say for sure. I have my doubts simply by dint of the fact that, like, I don't know how much directing experience and directing's pretty sink or swim to a great deal to a fair extent. You kind of end up having to be both the person who takes on a lot of the decision making, but depending upon the team, while taking on the decision making, you might kind of end up having to be someone who also has to give up a lot of personal creative vision. I don't think Kojima does this, but for a lot of teams, when you take on the directorial, and especially if if you're Kojima Productions and you're not Kojima, but suddenly you're thrust into the directorial role, I think you're going to be put in a position where you are technically the leadership, but you have to give up a lot of personal creative vision because you need to make sure that everyone is willing to work towards the same goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you become less impose my will, which is what a lot of, people associate with, especially someone like Kojima, someone that is known for their strong opinions. If you're handling Kojima Productions and you're not Kojima, I don't think you'll be able to pull that off. So you probably won't be able to be an impose my will director. You have to become this is the thing. This is me narrowing down all of our focuses to a single point of this is the thing we're actually making. This is the thing that helps our visions meet in the center. But that's just me throwing out my immediate thoughts. But there's simply no way of knowing until it happens. Let's see. When you make a game like Suikoden or Euden, how many characters can you realistically give the same amount of depth as a party member in an FF or Tales game? I think about 10. Like, that would just be my instinct. Like, go look at Final Fantasy games with more than 10 characters, and you start seeing characters like jokers that don't do much. And I'm looking at you, Umaro.
Rude.
Like, but like,
or Chrono Cross.
Yeah, well, Chrono Cross and Suikoden are instructive, because Suikoden has more characters than Chrono Cross, but Suikoden also has sort of tiers of characters as well, where you'll have characters like Victor or Flick, who have in the original, who have like game long period to develop, and then you'll have characters like Milich Oppenheimer or like the other generals that like they have a period to be developed by dint of the fact that you're fighting them, and then when they join you as a Star of Destiny, like that's largely the end of their relevance, but you have the game has a strong enough grasp in that like antagonistic role to help make it clear what they're going to be like as your advisor, so they can pop in for a few lines of dialogue in a scene and it doesn't feel like who the fuck are you. And that's a key thing about it, is also the way that you structure the story when you have these vast casts. In a very real sense, the next person you're going to recruit is what's dragging along both Chrono Cross and Suikoden. But Suikoden, the next person you're going to recruit, is dragging it along because they are often an oppositional force, or they are the thing that will help you defeat an oppositional force. Whereas in Chrono Cross, one of the things that frequently bogs the narrative down is that the person that joins your party is simply the next person who actually has some idea of what they want. So like your party ends up following them to help them because like, well, we don't know what else we're doing right now. But yeah, like I think about 10 tends to be like, if you want fully like nuanced developed characters, that's kind of your upper level limit for the structure that those games have. You get more than that and you start having to take shortcuts, like really strong, really clear characterization shortcuts. Because, you know, a character development sort of comes in scenes, and those scenes tend to, like, if we're looking at classic Final Fantasy, the classic Japanese RPG formula, we're looking at, you know, we get a dungeon, and then maybe that has a scene at the end of it that's then like sort of concluded in the next town or built upon in the next town. You do that, and the more characters that you get, the harder that becomes. Like, you look at like say FF9, ton of wonderful characters in that, most of them very well characterized, and then Amaranth is just there.
Mm-hmm.
Just doing his thing, has almost nothing because they just don't have time to do much with him. Like FF9 has one of the larger casts of anything other than like 6, I think. Like, I think 9 has like 9 primary characters. Let's see, Zidane, Dagger, Vivi, Steiner, Eiko, Quinna, Amaranth. I feel like there should be more than that. I think Beatrice. And Freya.
I mean, I was just joking, because Beatrice isn't technically a main cast character. She's just a secondary antagonist.
Yeah, but she is also one of the characters who gets a lot of scenes and has an arc that she goes through. So I think she still does kind of count. But yeah,
she does fight temporarily alongside the party for one scene. It was her and Steiner.
Yeah, she and Steiner. But yeah, like I think that's a key point here. It's like, you know, I've been focused on party, but like non-party characters also get that. So if you include like antagonists, you can probably get this to like 15 or 16. But that's kind of the upper limit of how many characters are going to have like real story relevance beyond a scene or two. So you need to be very economical in how you use them. Is it worth it to remove all the mythology-based Eidolons and just have an FF with original summons like Cactuar and Tonberry? Honestly,
calling some of them mythologically based is stretching mythology a bit.
Yeah, a little bit. Personally, if you ask me, I want a Final Fantasy game where the summons are just weird little dudes that show up sometimes instead of the root of the story for a while. Like, we have had... I don't think they have not been core to the story since, like, in one sense or another, since, like, 8?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm trying to think, like, 9, the fact that Dagger is a summoner, like, I guess 9 doesn't count either. Like, Dagger is a summoner being, is important, but the will of the summons is not.
Yeah.
Once you get to 10, the will of the summons becomes important. Like, they become, like, a factor as characters. And honestly, I think they need a break from that. Like,
I mean, I think in 9, Rayma actually did speak with Dagger.
He does, but only for one scene. His will is not a driving motivator in the plot.
No. It's actually kind of similar to how he shows up in Final Fantasy VI.
Mm.
In what was it, Zozo? Or
yeah,
Town? Zozo, yeah.
But yeah, like, if you look at, like, 10, the Faith themselves are a big mover and shaker in the story. I know nothing about 11's plot, but 12, like, there's a whole... I don't remember... jack shit about half of 12's plot. I think technically, like, the actual will of the... There's some stuff about the will of the gods in there, I think. But honestly, like, at this point, I would like a Final Fantasy game that is not about the will of existing gods for a while. I think it's become kind of a crutch. And, you know, you get to even ones that I quite like 15, huge part of that. 16, all about it. We need a break from them. It's been a minute. Let's see. So, yes. And also, I just like some of the little weirdos that they have that they've just ginned up. It's okay to just have some time. Like, we've had 2 games where they've tried to, like, put some bite back into Ifrit. We can just have some the weird little fuckers for a while. What are some cases of powerful tools in RPGs that came too late or had too high a cost to use, like F6's Meltdown and Crusader? I mean, like, if we're talking about coming too late, like, a lot of times, you know, you get into... that becomes a variable debate. Like, I mean, the eternal thing being, like, say, the ultimate weapons... or, you know, stuff like Knights of the Round, you get to the point where you have them, there's no point in using them. Like, there's nothing you need them for, because you were already good. You already had done enough game that none of that was ever going to matter.
Can I say Thunder Spell from Zelda 2?
We don't speak of Zelda 2.
Okay.
But yes, that does make sense. You are just forced to use that to fight one of the final bosses.
And if you didn't level up enough or get all of the magic containers, that could use up your entire magic bar. And then you can't use heal, you can't use shield, you can't use jump. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it just ends up a restriction. But, yeah, I'm trying to think of some other stuff. Like, you know, you run into this kind of thing a lot. Because, like, you know, just the structure of how endgame rewards are doled out tends to engender this. Like, it's almost ironic that if you play something, like, back when they were still starting with the idea of every character gets a unique ultimate weapon, some of the ultimate weapons in FF7 can be obtained relatively early and are not... like, are not difficult to obtain at all. My personal favorite being Sid's The Venus Gospel, which you can get by just, after doing the scene that launches the rocket in space, you just walk back and talk to a guy next to the rocket and he just gives it to you. But, yeah, that, like, the entire notion of how these are structured tends to make anything that's like the side quest best equipment useless. Like, if you have to fuck around in the bazaar a bunch at the end of 12, fuck that. Anything to do with the equipment upgrading system to get ultimate weapons in FF13, fuck that.
Yep.
Honestly, the easiest, like, the ones that stick out to me as the most, when I think of something that doesn't abide by this, it seems rarer, but also, like, the one time I can think of it in, like, Final Fantasy is very funny, because it's like, you can get the ultimate weapons relatively early, but they're also mostly useless, FF8. If you you don't need the magazines that tell you what the ultimate weapons ingredients are, you just need to have the ingredients for each character's ultimate weapon in order to craft it. But ultimate weapons in that game just aren't that useful. Like, for Squall, they have a purpose because they give him access to his better limit breaks, but for everyone else, it's just like, these are some raw stat boosts. You might as well have just junctioned, like, fucking Quake to your attack stat and had done with it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I'm trying to think of ones that are actively, like, detrimental to actually use. And nothing's immediately coming to mind. Okay, so there's a plug-and-play light gun called Game that uses predictive AI to do light gun things without needing a CRT or external sensor. It's since it's hard to pronounce how that's spelled, it's spelled GAIME. Interesting thing is that the device will get officially licensed port of Time Crisis, Steel Gunner, and Point Blank. What other light gun games would you like to see being sold again? House of the Dead? Like those? Like the original ones that don't look like shit? let's see. I don't think this actually deserves to come back, but I'm very fond of it because it was in every arcade for me as a child. So Area 51 from Midway. Let's see.
That was a weird game.
In terms of actually good ones, you could pull out some interesting, like, weirdo games from way back in the day. Elemental Gear Bolt is pretty neat. There is, Police 911 is really elaborate. I think you'd actually need more than just a light gun. You would need to concoct a bunch of other things to make that work, but it's a neat game. Let's see. Virtua Cop 2. Sega had some cool light gun games. Namco and Sega are kind of the big ones, as they so often are with that era of arcade games. But, just because it's funny and because I enjoy it, the Gun Survivor games from Capcom are bad but interesting, because they aren't on rails. They were light gun. I played Gun Survivor 2 Code Veronica in an arcade in like 2006, and it was just an extremely strange first person shooter that you controlled with a light gun. I think that those games are kind of weird and funny. A thousand times death wished upon the hated Carnival. Let's see. Anyone else got some fond light gun memories? Got any Project Horned Owl fans here?
I don't know. I played Virtua Cop on the Saturn, so I don't have much to say here. No, I told you guys about the summer family trip we went on to Old Orchard Beach in Maine, and one of my friends and I, we just kept putting quarters into House of the Dead and this Jurassic Park light gun game until we beat them. So expensive, very expensive.
I like that Jurassic Park game. It's fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh yeah, it's kind of neat. Okay, we're gonna hit some more of these before we go to bed because it sounds like Wheels is starting to die. Okay, you've already made your point clear about gamers wanting the very best and most complete package, but what about sports fans? How do you Americans deal with the broadcasting rights of entire leagues being divided between regional networks and subscription services? By suffering.
Yes. Yeah, there's no... How do we deal with that? Pain.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Like, there are usually, like, streaming or cable/satellite packages you can get that will get you everything, and they are so mind-bogglingly expensive.
I pay $30 a month for the right to watch the Red Sox current mediocrity.
I don't remember when I last looked at it, but like if you wanted like the I know they used to advertise this goddamn thing every year, like NFL Sunday Ticket or whatever.
Yeah.
It got you basically all of the games. It's like $80 a month. Like the answer is that we do it by suffering. Like you have to, like, honestly, it probably engenders a lot more like rivalry about local teams because it's just well, these are the guys I can actually fucking see in my market.
That's true. The local teams in NFL are probably still the easiest to watch because a lot of those are still on like just basic channels like CBS and
ABC. Fox. Yeah.
You could actually probably watch them over the air. But I mean, beyond that, it's just like pain. Like, what's your sport? Oh, I like soccer. Okay, you want to watch MLS? I think you have to. Not just get Apple TV, get an extra.
Out the ass.
I think that one's actually one of the cheaper ones. If you want to watch MLB, if you're not like
out of market games or whatever.
Out of market games, if you're not watching a local team, then you can buy MLB's streaming service, which is extremely good, but it is expensive as fuck.
They're in that horrible nexus of like a ton of teams, a lot of like popular enough that they can demand a premium.
The only one that's really good right now is if you're a fan of NHL and your team is not local, go Canucks, and you have ESPN Plus through the whole Disney package, you get all those games, I'm not going to say for free, as part of your subscription service.
Yeah, it's at least not an additional add-on. Like this is where we're at. It's at least not an additional add-on to your streaming. Every goddamn year I have to.
I think the one that could break all this, hopefully, maybe, would be like the WNBA. Like I think you can get most of their games through their streaming service right now. Although that's probably. Yeah, you probably will be locked out of your local teams still, especially as that league explodes in popularity. But it makes no sense, and it's just ridiculous.
Sometimes I just want to watch the storm.
Yeah. Like I don't really get it anyway because I swear. I don't have the financials in front of me or anything, obviously, but I swear if you just put it out there for cheap or not maybe not free, but at least very cheap, and get more people watching, you'd get a lot more ad revenue dollars, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe get more people going to your games for some of the teams that are struggling to like put people in the seats.
Yeah, like you definitely like, you know, live event local games especially make sense for things like MLB where there's like 9 million games a year.
Yeah.
But I
think especially some of the younger leagues in this country, like the MLS, a lot of teams are doing well, but I'm sure there's still some struggling for attendance. Like people have been trying to get soccer more popular in the U.S. forever, and we're finally making progress.
Slowly cracking that.
Yes, it takes time, people. Like people used to make fun of the WNBA, and people never, no one watching that. Like you need to build that shit over generations. It takes time. Yeah, I mean, it takes a lot of fucking time.
If you're establishing a new league, you are looking at like a 20-year investment.
Yes,
before it
at least
like a cultural institution.
At least.
Hmm.
And I think honestly, I think a good way to do that is just make it easy for people to watch your fucking product. Like I have not mm-hmm. watched our local team in the WNBA for years, not out of lack of interest, because it's just not available, and that's dumb. That's so dumb. And I don't get it. I have easier access to watch Premier League games than I do my own fucking local WNBA team that's leaving now.
I'd like to point out that this question seems to have woken Wheels up.
Yes, because this shit pisses me off. it sucks. It sucks.
Yeah, it's
so much.
Yeah, like there's a million sports to watch in America, and like there's a million great games to be watching at any given time, and half the time you cannot watch them because they have been locked into some extremely absurd bundle of other things that you don't want to watch or are just mind-bogglingly expensive on their own.
Yeah. I mean, we've got an additional ESPN service now, and I don't even know what sports you get access to on that. Like,
we are bringing back ESPN 8, the Ocho.
Yes, please.
Yes.
But I mean, really, like, as far as like a platform for really good sports, just that basic ESPN Plus has so much good. Like, I can their minor leagues of soccer, and which is the USL in the US, there's a lot of good soccer. You get all those games on there, and fuck it, I'm just gonna watch our local team on that, and fuck the MLS.
Like, this is what how they're gonna treat me.
Yeah, seriously, like, and that's not even getting into a lot of other things. Like they force places to build these giant stadiums, not to fit more people in. Like some of these new stadiums have fewer seats than they did before. They need more luxury boxes. Like it's hard.
They're just trying to like get the highest level of like rich guy shit.
It's it's just hard not to feel like insulted, honestly. It sucks. But it's also beautiful because the product on the field is often amazing, and thus the conundrum. Like if the sports that exist in the U.S. sucked, then no one watch it, and they would all just go away. But like they don't. Mm-hmm. Like
okay,
what are you gonna
do? Yeah, we've got a couple questions about video game, card game.
You don't say.
When you played FF8 for the first time, did you look up a guide? I have a soft spot for Triple Triad, but you need a guide if you want to unlock everything and not start hating that minigame because you have to play it over and over again. I had a guide, and I still didn't enjoy it.
I don't like that minigame. It's a bad card game.
My favorite thing about
Triple Triad. I didn't engage with it that much.
Yeah, my favorite thing about Triple Triad is that if you that like there's and like the official guide at the time would not tell you quite how this worked. I don't think that the person writing the guide fully understood it. But like there's an entire thing about like local rules that spread around if you play with different people, like we're going to play by local rules. And then like when you spread certain rules are advantageous, like the one that says that if you win, you get all of your opponent's cards, which can save you a lot of rematching someone over and over. But also those rules will eventually start to like they degrade down a list. So like eventually like if you get a rule spread around, it will start degrading into a different rule. It's extremely weird. But yeah, triple triad is like the mechanisms around triple triad are often significantly more complicated than triple triad itself. I just don't enjoy triple triad.
No, it's not fun, and it makes me annoyed.
Yeah, you can play it in Final Fantasy 14 as well, and I choose not to.
It's also bad there.
So we got a much quicker, a much simpler question. Triple Triad, Tetra Master, Queen's Blood, or FF9's Blackjack. Which one will you choose? Queen's Blood.
Queen's Blood. For always and forever.
None of the above. Like
that one has some interesting, like, the way it's presented in-game has some interesting puzzle elements, but it's also the only one that, like, has enough strategic variety that you can imagine how it would function as a real card game.
Yeah, there's actual deck building. I can spend some time building a deck.
Two different decks can have two different intended win states. Like that's all I'm really asking at this point. Even if I'm not going to love it, I at least want to have like two different options for what I'm actually, at least more than one option for what my deck is built to do. Let's see. Remember FF4's Proto-Babel and how you have to use steel on Zoromas to unlock that boss. How often do you remember to use steel on bosses? Never. Unless I have some specific guide laid out for me telling me that, like, no, you want to steal this. It's like, I will never think to do it on my own.
I know, I mean, in my case, I think... In Chrono Trigger, I think Ayla had the highest level of anybody at the end because I always made sure she was present for a boss so I could steal something off of it.
You can steal a bunch of, like, stat-ups, I think, at endgame as well, which is how you get everyone to, like, stat-level stupid.
Mm-hmm. What was the name of the cave woman in Chrono Trigger?
Ayla. We just brought her up.
Okay. She's awesome. Yeah, okay. I forgot her name, but she's awesome.
Yeah, everyone loves Ayla. Ayla fight for world.
Yeah.
Let's see. Oh, this is Gaijin. Would be the only one who might be aware of this. Has there ever been any other game that was re-released to have more easily understandable grammar like FF4 Easy Type?
Meh?
Huh? Wait, is it more easily understandable grammar?
Yeah, because like FF4 Easy Type, one of the things it did aside from making the game actually easier was that it uses different words to make the game easier to understand for lower levels of like Japanese literacy.
Oh,
okay. I wasn't aware of that. Not really. No.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as I was aware, FF4 Easy Type was basically just the American version ported back over, wasn't it?
No, it makes its own changes.
I don't think I know of any other version of a game that does that.
Yeah, if you're ever curious, Legends of Localization, Tomato, in his like comparison of all the localizations, also has the Easy Type script up and like kind of calls out in particular cases where the wording has been simplified to make it easier for younger readers.
Hmm.
But yeah, I've never heard of such a thing. The closest thing I could think of, and I don't think this would per se serve the same purpose, but it would be like the way that Pokemon, at least in like Circa Black and White, right when they were introducing like the proper kanji to it, you still had like the option to do it like the old ones, but I don't think that would actually make it easier to read.
Yeah. I mean, I could say, okay, some versions were technically easier to read just because the kanji count was that much different.
Hmm.
Also did not necessarily mean that they were easier to read for other reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah, not aware of any other games like that. Is there any game, book, or film that actually uses Hepburn romanization?
Trying to remember what. Well, can you repeat that again? What?
Asking, is there any game, book, or film that actually uses Hepburn romanization?
It's standard. Why? I mean, what in what kind? Just for spelling things?
Presumably.
If you see a CHI or SHI in there, then it's Hepburn romanization.
Mm-hmm.
The other standard romanization is actually not. I
forget what its name is.
I can't remember what its name is either, but they phased it out. It's officially no longer supposed to be used in school contexts as of like last year, so it's been slow going.
Oh, they finally just like ripped the Band-Aid off and said no more of that.
Yeah, which, I mean, on the one hand, okay. On the other hand, Hepburn has its own issues and historical issues.
Naturally.
Being the fact that Hepburn style is the romanization that favors Americans being able to properly pronounce stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Without bothering to learn other things.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be like the equivalent of somebody insisting that the Polish change all of their spelling so that the pronunciations make sense.
Mm-hmm.
When Polish is a highly phonetic language and everything does make sense as long as you understand how the letters are supposed to be working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's like that romanization scheme was called Nihon Shiki?
Yeah, that's just the Japanese... Yeah, it makes sense. Japanese style. Basically, the Nihon Shiki was designed to match up very well to the hiragana katakana chart.
Mm-hmm.
Without needing to create consonant digraphs.
Mm-hmm.
And if T-I just happened to be pronounced chi in Japanese, that was no weirder than what a lot of the European languages were doing with their phonemes.
Mm-hmm.
And like, barely 5% as weird as everything that English does with its spelling.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I've had conversations about this before, about with people who are like, oh, but Hepburn Shiki is so much easier to pronounce. It's like that's only because nobody's bothering to put an effort in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, if you can remember that tortilla is pronounced tortilla, not tortilla. And you can remember that sushi is pronounced sushi and not sushi. So, meanwhile, I mean, honestly, I'm fine with Hepburn Shiki. I don't mind it at all as just being in use. It exists as a... primarily as a colonialist construct of 1950s Reconstruction.
Hmm.
It exists only because the U.S. military had wanted to make sure that nobody had any basic problems with with figuring out what a word was supposed to sound like.
Hmm.
So, and I have seen the Soldier's Guide to Japanese vocabulary that they produced during the Second World War, and some of the I spellings that they put on those words were just ridiculous. Just like, oh no. So again, I'm not quite sure what he's getting on with this question to begin with, because the majority of official romanizations still use Hepburn Shiki for Japanese to English for like video game character names.
Hmm.
Except Pokemon. Maybe, maybe not, depending. So it gets weird with some of the Pokemon names.
Yeah. Okay, so my like voice is probably at its limit, so we might want to get this closing out right about now.
Sounds good.
Okay. Tell me about. I know that you've got new things to tell us of, Gaijin.
Oh yeah. So as of last week, I have the Sin of Tantalus available on Kindle Unlimited under the name Michael Spearwater.
Nice.
And so yeah, that one's cozy cannibalist dystopia. basically all of the tropes I could adapt from zombie fiction without any zombies. Technically. Theoretically. People are still trying to eat the protagonist.
Well, weird.
Not rough. Yeah. Not in a metaphorical manner, and just straight up, he is delicious. And there's a bit of a problem here. But yeah, it's available on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. It's... I am very bad at trying to sell these things, honestly. But yeah, it's... Imagine if there was a zombie plague, but the zombie virus turned you into a zombie victim and not an actual zombie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's basically what's happening here is... everyone else is attacking him. Or potentially. He has to keep going out of his way to reduce or minimize... dangers to himself while being blamed for all the dangers to himself. Because since this is an issue that is affecting a very small portion of the population as of current, it's not being treated very seriously as an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, I wrote this originally in like 2018. I did not intend for it to be more topical now than it was when I wrote it.
More topical by the day.
Yeah, but it's like the biggest issue in here is the public at large doesn't care as long as they still can get the yummy food that they enjoy and which is directly causing the problem. For a small percentage of the population. And yeah. So yes, the Sin of Tantalus. Again, what was, do you remember from Greek mythology what the Sin of Tantalus was?
I'm sure that if I were more of brain at the moment, I would, but I do not at this exact moment.
Oh. Yeah, well, Tantalus was one of the mortal sons of Zeus, and so he had basically some special privileges and stuff, so he could just like invite his dad and all the other gods to dinner at times. And he decided he was going to have some fun with this, unquote fun in the Greek tragedy sense, and served his own son up as soup.
Ew.
You know.
To try and force the gods, or try to trick the gods into a sin of eating people.
You know, as a joke.
Yeah. They did not appreciate this. This is how Tantalus ended up getting punished for eternity in Tartarus. Which is what he's more famous for at this point. But yeah. Tantalus. And then I have another one coming out in July. Which is the one that's getting published in out of pure spite, basically. but I'll tell you more about that one later.
Oh boy!
But yeah, there's a whole story behind that. Yes. The Sin of Tantalus by Michael Spearwater, available on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. near future or reasonably present time, social contagion, zombie adjacent dystopia, or one particular person. Other people are doing just fine, thank you very much. So screw him.
Okay.
Sorry. But yes, I'm very bad at trying to explain these things.
Understandable. Yeah. It's tough.
Yeah.
Then Joe, where can we find your stuff?
Okay, so yeah, you can hang on, sorry. I was doing stuff on my TV. Alright, yeah. You can still find me on twitch.tv/rpgamer, which you might be watching or listening to right now. And I still do my streams on Tuesday and Thursday nights from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern Time. And I'm currently playing Xenoblade Chronicles X Definitive Edition, Switch 2 Edition. And having a ball with that game for the most part. It's fun most of the time. And you can also check me out on YouTube under Smoke and Joe Gamer. Yeah, I haven't been doing a lot of content lately. I did do a short video of just the first hour of Shadow Labyrinth. And so far, Metroidvania has not really been happening yet, although I was playing the Link to the Past Super Metroid Combo Randomizer again. That's fun, even though I've yet to complete a seed because I always get stuck. And,
Sound like Shadow Labyrinth.
No, Shadow Labyrinth, I'd like to put more time into. And also, Wheels and I have been playing some Overwatch, so we were playing that on Shenanigans last night. So on Sunday nights, I don't know, starting sometime between 10 p.m. and 12 a.m. and then going till we get too tired to play. We play various games, and so, yeah, last night we were doing Overwatch, which kind of feels fresh again. There's a lot of new heroes, new maps, new modes. They drop the two, and it's just regular Overwatch. So, yeah, it's been going pretty well.
It feels fresh, and Marvel Rivals no longer does.
No. Marvel Rivals has major character balancing issues, especially when you have Deadpool who can play every role. Ugh. I love Deadpool, but he kind of ruined the game for me. So beyond that, I was just revisiting Forza Horizon 4, Forza Horizon 5, tying up some loose ends, getting ready for 6, which just came out an hour ago, unless you bought the whole crazy expensive early access edition, which I did not do. So I'm not going to buy it yet, but that's on my list. And yeah, I love, big fan of car PGs. They are quite fun. So yeah, then you can also follow me on Blue Sky under Smoke and Joe Gamer. I recently just posted some pictures of some like anime statue things that I've collected over the years. I post all sorts of things whenever I feel like. So yeah, you can follow me on Blue Sky. And that's all I got for you.
Okay, and as for us, you can ask us questions like dear friend Fire Miner by catching us on Mondays around 8:30 or 9 the RP Gamer channel, twitch.tv/RPGamer. If you catch it in the chat, we will answer as best we can before we start dying.
You sound like you're dying.
Yeah, I'm gonna, while we work this out, I wanna like let Fire Miner's last question be clarified so that it's not too confused. Fire Miner's saying, what I mean is Hepburn versus Kunray, and when, in which context do people use either?
Kunray is, or yeah, Nihonshiki Kunray is primarily taught in elementary school as part of data entry. Because, like I said, it's much easier to map the combinations of letters to the hiragana chart without having the kids have to figure out why C and H come together here instead of just doing C-A-T-I-T-U-T-E-T-O. Achitsuteto.
Yeah.
So that's the main reason to keep using it. Is that reason. And the main reason why it was invented in the first place, because, again, 150 years ago, Japanese people were not very used to alphabetic writing systems. And this was much easier to work with. And then, of course, going on about, let's say, about 80 years ago, starting 80 years ago, and who were deliberately or obtusely refusing to learn how to pronounce these things right. So Banshiki became more dominant then. But still, people will often use both.
Depending upon, it sounds like which someone uses is as much down to personal preference as anything.
Yeah, though in junior high school we have to strongly encourage the kids to use Hetban over Kunrei just because, well, mostly just because, but also because it helps with the English, remembering how to pronounce English words. So,
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But yeah. Okay. So last little bits before we close out. You can also ask us questions by going to the RP Gamer Discord and putting them in the podcast section. You can also ask us questions by going to the comments section under this very episode. If you don't have access to the RP Gamer Discord, if you go to the community tab, you will find all you need there. It's a lovely community, whether you want to ask us questions or not. Okay. I am dying. It's over. I am going to fall asleep.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
Thank you, Joe.
See ya.
See ya.
What fun. What fun.
Okay.
This is the way.
You know what? He just left.
Did I hit them all?
It stinks.
Maybe. I think you did.
Wait, hold on.
Resident Evil.
Almost.
Nerd!
There we go. We're good.
Yeah.